Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties, bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will discuss two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last five, the most recent ones, including this one just as soon as we get off the air, are archived at our website at recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. Now this time we're going to talk about effective communication. Now we always talk about communication, right? We talk about dealing with other people and with participants and workshops and seminars and how to handle it. But the question is effective. What works? What's effective? What are we doing that we could do better? And what are we doing that we're doing right? So I think that usually we have a starting question, of course, and I think that the main one is, what is effective communication? What does it mean to say that? How do we know when we've got it? Thank you. I see there's lots of participation. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for your participation. This is really a good answer and pretty much encompasses it, and we can now go away. No, just kidding. Cooper says, in answers to what is effective communication, he says, whatever works. That's a good summation, isn't it? Whatever works is effective. If it's working, if it's being successful, if we're going forward, if we're getting to a successful outcome, and we're going step by step, and we're doing it, well, it works. So whatever works. And you know, yeah, people are saying that I say that all the time. And yeah, I kind of do, don't I? And thank you for all of your participation. It's true. I always say that Recipe for Peace Now has no actual rules about what you're supposed to do. Whatever, if it's working and it works for this particular group, and we're getting to a successful conclusion, and we are having good discussion, and we are participating well, you're doing good. Whatever works. Good point. Whatever works. Yes. I like it. And Miranda and others are saying that effective communication is when you clearly state your objectives. We know where we're going because we have had it clearly told to us what it is that our objective is, what we are working towards, our successful outcome. What is it? What do we want? Mm-hmm. And this is a good point too. Hussein and others are saying that effective communication is not only stating your objectives, which we revisit sometimes during the process, but we rather decide what our objective is at the beginning, right? But Hussein says that it's being able to answer questions clearly. What a good point. Being able to answer questions clearly. And we're getting some addition to that. Being able to answer questions clearly and without offense. Very good point also. You know how some people are very, very certain that they've already answered that? Because if you were paying attention, you would have understood it. Well, that means they haven't been very clear, but they think they've been clear. So they get kind of touchy about answering questions. That's not effective, is it? If someone's asking a sincere question, and not just to bog the process down, if someone really wants to know something, if they're asking a sincere question, it needs to be answered, because obviously the communication has not been clear. Mm-hmm. Because don't know the answer. Tell me, what is that? You know, I always say at the very beginning, and I say it quite frequently, I think, that whenever I do a workshop or seminar, and I always say, you know, there are no stupid questions. If you don't understand something, if you don't understand where we're going, if you don't understand what it is that we're doing or why, if you don't understand it, then probably other people in the room don't understand it. They just haven't had the guts to ask the question, or they didn't realize the question that they didn't understand. You see? And everybody listens when somebody asks a question, and they listen to the answer. And the main thing is to be able to answer the questions. Very nicely done, yes. And to be able to give a reasonable answer. And if you don't know the answer, to be able to say, well, let's research that. Just think about that. That's a new question that we haven't discussed. Or have we? You see, you have to think about it. What, has it been covered? Is it something that needs to be examined? Right, being able to answer questions. You know what? Quite a few people, thank you for your participation, are saying that not only being able to answer questions, but being able to ask questions. Mm-hmm. Being able to ask questions and having a discourse that enables that. Mm-hmm. Being able to ask questions and being able to get an answer. Mm-hmm. And very important that we have the give and take, that the up and back, and people aren't just sitting there silently wondering, but they're too scared or embarrassed to ask. Mm-hmm. That means we don't have effective communication. Mm-hmm. Ella says that effective communication is creating a clear mission statement so that everyone understands the goals. Quite a few people are using the word mission statement. Sometimes in a group, quite a few are advocating actually at the beginning of the process making an actual written down mission statement so that you understand clearly your goal. I'm all for that as long as the mission statement really helps to understand the goal. Yeah, we're getting kind of a division about whether or not people like to create a mission statement and whether or not it should be revisited during the process. Depends how long the process is, right, and how complex the issues. Ah, good point. And it also depends on whether or not the mission statement was truly a statement of our mission. Or has it changed? Mm-hmm. As we get into the process, sometimes what we viewed as our absolute mission changes slightly. Or else some outside influence causes it to change. And we need to revisit. Mm-hmm. People are asking how come I'm not that fond of a mission statement. It's not that I'm not fond of one. And I think it's a good thing, especially if you've got a very diverse group and they're there for the same outcome, but not for the same reason, because sometimes that happens. We all like the same thing, but the reason we want it is different. For example, some of us want it for economic reason. Some of us want it for a cultural reason. You know what I mean? There's different reasons for it. Mm-hmm. And it depends on the group. I know I say it depends a lot. People are going, you said it depends again. Well, it does, though. It depends on the group and the complexity of the mission, because sometimes we don't need a mission statement. We all know what we want to do. We want to have a stoplight put in or something. You know what I mean? It's real clear. There is one goal. We all have it, and that's our mission. We don't need to mess around with making an actual written statement. Sometimes the mission statement is necessary because we don't all understand exactly what the goal is. I find it is depending on the group. Sometimes you argue about the semantics of the mission statement, and it makes for a kind of unnecessary argument, unnecessary potential hostility. If we're actually writing down, and also sometimes it takes a long time, and it doesn't get us anywhere. I'm only in favor of mission statements, and this is just from my own experience. I'm in favor, and I'm getting a lot of agreement of this, I'm in favor if it will cause the process to go forward, but not if we're going to get bogged down in the actual wording. Mm-hmm. And yes, people are saying that you must have a very clear and concise mission statement. Thank you for all of your participation. A lot of people advocating something that is, giving examples, something that is less than a sentence long. It's kind of just what we're going to do, what our goal is. It's really a goal statement, isn't it? What we'd like to achieve. Mm-hmm. More so the mission statement's kind of a catch-all term. But it's really what we'd like to do, why we're here. Mm-hmm. If it's gonna advance the process, wonderful. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that is effective communication, too, to cause the process to advance by making a mission statement, a goal, an objective. Right. Yeah. And if we do it concisely and clearly, then we have had effective communication. Very good point. Mm-hmm. So what else is effective communication? Thomas says, when participants are satisfied that the discussion is heading to a successful outcome. Ah, very good point. The participants are satisfied. People keep coming. They can see that they're getting somewhere because we're effectively communicating with each other. And also the point is being made very well. We're effectively communicating with the outside world, too, because we think of effective communication within our group. We're discussing, we're getting the points, we're working towards our goal, what should we do? But one of the main things, most of the time, is that then effective communication must be made with others, with the outside world, because we want somebody out there to listen to our group decision, right? We want to change something. We want to have an effect. We want to change something or prevent change. Good point. But we want to make our voice heard. And the point is being made, and thank you, by quite a few people, that one of the most important items of effective communication, one of the important ways to do it, is to talk to the media, to get their attention. To get their attention favorably, says George. Yes, very good point, because bad media is a bad thing. But yes, we need to effectively communicate, not just amongst ourselves, but then when we make our decision, when we find out what we're going to do, we need to communicate that outwardly to whoever it is that has the power to do it. Right? Right. So, yes, effective communication and to, you know, the phrase is being used, rise above the clutter. Rise above the clutter. This is, of course, an international show, a global show, and I think that may be American idiom. But it means that there's an awful lot of good works vying for attention, media attention. And there are an awful lot of ways to media communicate nowadays. And I'm getting a lot of people mentioning all kinds of different ways. The internet, all kinds of ways on the internet. And, of course, the social media. And, well, yes, these radio stations, right? And also the traditional media. Mm-hmm. And all of this is needs to be thought of as ways to effectively communicate what it is that we want. Because if we can't say what we want, then how can somebody provide it for us? Right. Yeah, effective communication outside our group. Good point. So now that we've decided what effective communication is, how on earth do we do it? Because, of course, this is a pragmatic show. We talk about how to do things and not just the theory of what should be done. You can read a lot about theory, but what you really want to know is how are we going to do that? Mm-hmm. Yes, we're still talking media. A lot of people are saying an effective press release. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it needs to be concise. And, you know, this is a very good point that's being made, and thank you, Heather and others, that the media, even the, I don't like to call it non-traditional, because quite frankly it's become traditional nowadays, it's not that unusual, but like even social media and blogs and things like that, and online news, but also the more traditional ones that are like magazines and newspapers and radio and television and things, they still got power. And so all of this, if you're going to do a press release, which has been commented upon, and Heather knows these things, as quite a few of you do, thank you, it's good to send something, send something concise that effectively communicates who you are and what you want, who your group is and what you want and what needs to be done and why. Needs to be grammatically correct, needs to be spelled properly. Yes, do not crab at me. It needs to be spelled properly because otherwise it looks ignorant, as well as grammatically correct. And this is true of all languages because I know this is a global show. And it should be something because the media is made of humans, right? And they're very, very busy and they see a lot of stuff past their desk, even if the desk is virtual, but they see a lot of stuff. It needs to be interesting, might need a photo, would be an okay thing, but it also needs to be ready to just repeat so that the reporter, and I'm going to call everybody a reporter who gives your message out to the world, so that the person that's doing it, that's receiving it, can just, essentially speaking, copy and paste it. They don't have to worry about it. They don't have to mess with it. It says exactly what it means, and it is ready to go out. Very important. Thank you. Very important as a how-to. Yeah. It has to be carefully crafted and neat and proper and also so that somebody can just go, yeah, I've got, I don't know, an inch of space somewhere. That looks good. Let's put that in. And then it'll get attention, right? Right. Mm-hmm. Sari says that you effectively communicate by using clear and concise language to restate the decisions for agreement. That's clear and concise within your group, and also clear and concise about your decisions that are now put outside your group, mm-hmm. so that the world can do it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jared says that how to effectively communicate. You can effectively communicate by taking turns within your group. Yeah, good point. And we've talked about turn taking, about when someone is entitled to speak and have the floor, mm-hmm. and that everyone is entitled and we take turns when we speak, right? Yeah. People are asking about this, about how you get people to take turns. And, you know, there's some people in this world, and of course we all know this, who are very fond of speaking, and some people who are rather shy and they don't really like to speak to the group. So I'm an advocate of having everybody take a turn, especially when we're deciding a key point, and actually asking people's opinion. Mm-hmm. And we have talked about this on prior shows. By the way, if you want to hear prior shows, the last five are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. So, but we've talked about using a tool to enforce the turn taking. And, of course, we established that that's what we're going to do at the beginning of the process so that no one feels that perhaps they've been in some way singled out as a bad turn taker. And I personally like to have something that keeps time in the room that is not just me calling the time that everyone can see. I actually, and you know, you do as you please and whatever suits the group that you're dealing with. Personally, I actually use a cooking timer. One of those little wind-up things that goes ding and everybody can see it and you can see it counting down so that you know that you need to wrap up. And whatever we decide is the time limit for each person to speak, we take turns and then we can go round again, you see? But then everybody knows that they have a certain amount of time. That makes them more concise and clear. Good point, yes. That's more effective communication because you can't just prattle on. You must make your point. And everybody gets a turn, yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially when there's issues to really be decided and there's a lack of consensus and we all have to talk, taking turns. Mm-hmm. You know, and Hannah and others are saying that that's one of the ways to enforce the civility rules. And we have spoken about civility quite a bit. And really it is, depending on the group, sometimes I have actually handed out rules of civility about being courteous to your fellow person and not interrupting and like that. And that is one of the ways, the keeping time for the turns is one of the ways of enforcing the civility rules indeed. And then we have time for rebuttal and like that so that everybody gets their chance. You know, Bugsby and others are saying that. And it's a very good point. I don't often have this, but I have seen it done. And that if you're going to have effective communication and all of the people are not native speakers to each other, you know, English is, of course, what I deal in, but whatever your language is, whatever the people in your group will speak to each other, if not everybody is a native speaker of the same language, you might need an interpreter for effective communication. And that's not at all unreasonable, especially if it's an international issue. I've used interpreters. I like to get people asking what kind of an interpreter. Personally, I like an impartial third-party interpreter. I really don't like somebody to bring their own who's like a family member, if we can possibly help it, or another member of their group, because the interpreter will start to argue, if you know what I mean. They'll become a participant, even though they're not really the right person to be a participant. Yeah, if someone needs an interpreter, and I know this, or they tell me in advance, I do like an impartial third party who actually gets paid and is just there to interpret the words, just to say what someone is saying, or to interpret what others are saying to the individual or to the group. Yeah, good point about interpreter if you have language barriers. Thank you. Anna says that it's good to have a conference call or a Skype call for those who are unable to attend. I do indeed like people to be able to be on a conference call because they're going to hear about the meeting, and it might not be effectively communicated or properly communicated what happened, because when someone tells you something, it is just human nature to have it be biased by the speaker's personal opinion, mm-hmm. because they're not repeating it exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a very good point, too. I think we're going to go on to how do we effectively communicate non-verbally, because this is all verbal communication, right? And we talked about non-verbal communication in our topic. Mm-hmm. And we're getting quite a few people asking about how come we're talking only verbal and why, what should we do with non-verbal communication? How do we effectively communicate non-verbally? Mm-hmm. Panya says that you write down the spoken ideas and lessons so that you can see them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's often quite helpful to use, like a whiteboard or something, whatever kind of technology you might be using, but to actually have the leader, which is usually us, write down the spoken ideas and decisions so that you can see them. And then we all know what we're talking about. And then, if it's not written down and that's not what people had in mind, they can say so. They can say, no, that's not what I thought we said. Wait a minute there. Is that what everybody interpreted it to be? You see, and it helps, especially if the process is fairly ongoing and we have to go step by step. Mm-hmm. In order to reach a decision and then effectively communicate what we want to the outside world, mm-hmm. or effectively communicate what we want within the group. Good point. But if you write it down for everyone to see and we agree on it, we've got agreement there, and now we can go on. Yeah, towards a successful outcome. Very good point. Mm-hmm. Hayden says that you make the minutes of the meeting and distribute it timely. Somebody's taking notes. Make the minutes. Minutes are often interesting because they say who was there, mm-hmm. and what was said. Mm-hmm. Somebody's taking notes. Good point. A lot of times if you've got an event, a seminar, a workshop, a mediation, usually, an arbitration, and somebody's taking minutes, somebody has notes, and we want to review it, actually verbatim, actually word for word, mm-hmm, then we usually take a video recording or a sound recording, and we distribute it as an attachment in email. That's what we do. We often, it's not a video in the sense that it's pretty, if you know what I mean. It doesn't get edited. It doesn't take a long time. But we have, in fact, we actually use a video camera, just a computer video camera, just at the head of the table, so that we all really can re-listen and rethink and revisit so that we can go forward when we're not actually sitting all in the room together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it helps decision-making. And what we do is we just distribute it as an email attachment. People are saying YouTube. Yes, maybe, not really, because YouTube is not secure, right? And everybody in the whole universe can see it, and it stays there forever. We would like something oftentimes, especially with clients, but even not with clients, even with groups who are not specifically just clients, we oftentimes would like a record made of the proceedings, the word escapes me. But like dictation. People are saying dictation, but somebody taking notes at the time. Mm-hmm. But also a sound recording is good. Yeah, but not on a service that is completely public. Something, please, that has a password to it. Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of people are naming all kinds of companies that do this, all kinds of, can we call them platforms? Thank you very much. Yes, we don't actually advocate a specific service on this show, although after I said that, I know there are quite a few free ones that need a password. I'm kind of fond of Vimeo, just for short stuff, but that's just me. Okay. And yes, we make a recording of what went on so that we can all think on it, the minute, so to speak. So how else do we effectively communicate non-verbally? You know, we've got a lot of ideas here. And one of the main ones is that we effectively communicate non-verbally with our attitude. Yeah. We are welcoming. We are friendly without being unprofessional, right? Our attitude, people calling it openness and inclusion. Inclusion of everybody who wants to participate. Yeah, our attitude is very important. Whether we are welcoming. Mm-hmm. You know, this is interesting. People are talking about, and thank you for all of your participation, under welcoming and attitude of the group dynamic, and the attitude of the leader, which really affects the group dynamic, right? What we do really affects the whole thing. Mm-hmm. People are talking about what I want to call the physical plant, the actual thing that we're sitting in, the room. And one of the main points that's being said is that you need to have, if you're going to communicate nonverbally and have a good attitude and openness and inclusion, and also that you need to watch your tone of voice, right? Because what you say can look okay on paper, but if you say it nasty or sarcastically, bad thing, tone of voice. So, but people are talking about the physical environment. And it is indeed an attitude of the leader. If we know how many people are coming and we don't have enough seats, ever seen that? Yeah. Or some of the seats are really comfortable and some of them really are not. Ooh, people are saying that they've had leaders of groups give them people different times so that the favored ones get the good seats up front because they've been told 15 minutes earlier. Wow, that's attitude now, isn't it? It's also a sign of bias. Mm-hmm. Quite a few people talking about comfortable temperature, too. It's not drafty. It's not stuffy. It's comfortable to sit there. It will make the process smoother and keep it going, right? People want to come again. Enough food and drink, good point. And people are making a point about utensils. We don't often think about that. You got to have enough stuff to eat your food with, enough plates and forks and napkins and things. Yeah. Yes, this is a very good point, too. Attitude and nonverbal communication is often shown by not having enough handouts. You know, we pretty much know how many people are coming, right? Because we've asked, who's coming? We've sent around the invite, we've sent around the invitation, we've sent around the emails, people have replied. We need to have, and we're going to hand out something that we're going to use or we're going to take with us. Those of you who have been here before, and thank you for coming back again. I see we have lots of participation. Thank you. Know that I am not real fond of a handout at the time. I like to see it in advance as an attachment or as a mailing even, so that we can all think on it and we don't spend our precious time together looking down and trying to trying to understand the fairly complicated written material that's just been handed to us. No, we want to see in advance. It's one of my big rules, send in advance. But not having enough handouts is a real good point, because it's not fair to make people share, because we all look at things at different speeds. I personally like to flip all over the place. I like to look at the front and then at the back, to look at the conclusions, flip it up and back. Who's going to want to share with me? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What other nonverbal communication? Richard and quite a few other people are saying that smiling and encouraging discourse is excellent nonverbal communication. Yeah, smile at people. Show that they are welcome. Mm-hmm. That we're going to encourage them. Mm-hmm. Showing enthusiasm, Carolyn and others are pointing out, is a big nonverbal communication. Yeah, motioning people in, showing enthusiasm, the tone of voice too, isn't it? And the look on your face. Mm-hmm. You know, Tadeo and others are pointing out that body language, in addition to the smiling and like that, and the attitude, is very important. And we've got body language that is open, that is welcoming, right? How about leaning forward? Yeah. I'm interested in you. I am leaning forward to really understand and really show you that I want to hear what you're saying, instead of leaning back with my arms crossed, right? Mm-hmm. Hand gestures, good point. Hand gestures make a difference in body language. Yeah, sometimes they're accidentally rude. Mm-hmm. Got to be careful about that. And, of course, making eye contact with the speaker is very important. Making eye contact with the group is important as the leader. When I lead, I look all around at everyone. I make eye contact kind of rotationally, not in a circle or anything, but I make sure that I'm really engaging with everyone, because then they will engage with me. Because I've shown interest. Yeah. Jacqueline's making a very good point, and others too, thank you, about paying attention and not texting or looking at mobile devices. Yes. Nothing worse than a whole room full of people who are somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, you'd like to hear their opinion and not the opinion of the invisible person who you don't know and haven't invited, who they've just texted and they've given an opinion, right? Right. Paying attention, not texting or looking at mobile devices. I have a turn-off rule. We turn off the ringer. Sometimes it's hard to have people turn the mobile device completely off. People are very attached to their mobile devices. And quite a few are saying that you confiscate them at the door, kind of like weapons. It depends. Depends on the group. Depends on whether they'll let you. I usually go for the turn off the ringer rule, because that's really distracting. And we do take breaks, where people not only get to have a lovely treat from our potluck, but they also can take a look at their mobile device, text somebody that they're going to be late, whatever, yeah. Mm-hmm. Leonard and others are saying also not holding side conversations. Very important, because you cannot effectively communicate with the group if you are not communicating with the group. You're just talking to the person next to you who you probably came with. Mm-hmm. So what are we doing that has been effective in our communication methods? Mm-hmm. You know, Stephanie and others are saying that one of the most effective things to do is staying in regular contact through email and other ways of discussion. Staying in regular contact. And that is very important, because you can't always physically meet, right? But you've got ideas that need to be researched, fleshed out. We want to go forward. This is not just an exercise in talking to each other. Well, all right, I've done exercises too. But we're assuming that it's not. We need to keep in constant contact so that we know we're, first of all going down the same path. We're still in agreement. And what has been tasked, what people are supposed to do, they've done. Regular contact. Paul says creating teams who then communicate with the entire group. We've talked about team building, and especially if it's a very big group, you definitely want to make teams. Or if you've got expertise within the group in different areas, you might have people break into groups that are of equal expertise, and they research and discuss and bring their findings to the whole group. You know, Cynthia has an interesting idea. I've done this once or twice. I don't usually have such a large group, but I can really see the point depending on what the issues are and the dynamic of the group itself. She says that you should be changing team members on a regular rotation. So you've made teams, and they've been asked to do something. And the team members kind of get to know each other fairly well, right? Because it's just natural, it's a smaller group. And you're working on something together. Cynthia advocates changing team members in a regular rotation. Depending on what it is you're doing, I do this in classes that are lasting an entire term, right? I teach an MBA. I teach several types of MBA classes. A Master of Business is an MBA, yeah, because the Global Show, people are saying, what's that? Yeah. And when you've got a class, I change the teams after each project because it forces people to learn how to deal with everybody, with all kinds of people, and you don't keep your same team for the entire term. Right? And in the artificial atmosphere of a class, it works extremely well because we don't have a common goal, a successful outcome. Well, I suppose we do to get a good grade from me. But you understand that rotation teaches you how to deal with other people. I'm very big on it in the classroom. We do it all the time. Real life, you have to be a little careful because you do want people to come up with an opinion, a product, a decision, and go forward and get the job done. And it doesn't hopefully take an entire term, so to speak. But yeah, if you can, it's an excellent idea. And people get to deal with other people. Excellent. Zach and others are advocating conference calls in between regular physical meetings. You know, it's a very good idea because it does keep everyone engaged. You feel that you're still part of the group. And also, it really depends how often you meet, doesn't it? Yeah. If you're meeting once a week or something, well, you keep in contact with what we're doing on the next meeting. Excuse me. Didn't mean to sneeze. Pardon me. Oh, thank you. People are saying bless you. But yeah, to keep in regular contact is the idea. You know, Janice is giving me a wonderful segue into the food portion of this show, and I can't resist. She says that discussing and coordinating the food will keep the group interested, and it's a good way to start the contact, and then you discuss other things too. And it's a very good point. We always say that the food aspect, because we advocate, Recipe for Peace now, advocates having food in the room like a potluck, so that when you have the breaks or when you need to have a time out, you have something nice to do. It'll keep people in the room because it's delicious, it's fun, everybody likes to eat. Yeah. But the food is really a tool to get us talking to each other. And we could talk to each other about the food before we get in the room, right? We could coordinate who's bringing what kind of a dish. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm going to say the same thing now that I say on all the shows. If you want to hear prior shows, by the way, the last five archived at our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. The thing that I always say is, and it's very, very important, is if you're going to have food, you need to communicate amongst each other at least this much about the food, but it is communication in between time, concerning any allergies, food prohibitions, or religious prohibitions about types of food. You don't want anybody to have a bad time. Also, I think that as the leader, we should have a little extra because really it's because I hate running out of food because it doesn't make for a nice convivial atmosphere. And it's good. Well, networking is an overused word, but it's good networking. You get away from the formality of the process. Mm-hmm. And I think that the leader should not only have a little extra, but also have a safe recipe. Now, we're going to talk about our safe recipe, which this time is a chili with meat. Don't have meat eaters, make it vegetarian. Yeah. When I make it vegetarian, I put in corn instead of the meat. I don't know why. I just think it's pretty, and it tastes nice. Just kernels of corn. You know me, I'm going to use frozen. If you're going to use fresh, it'll probably be better than mine. But in any event, a safe recipe is very important to have because it's something that you have now taken the survey among your participants and it's something they all can eat. Mm-hmm. Now, what makes a safe recipe a safe recipe? Not too many ingredients. Ingredients that we are fairly certain that everyone can eat. And it is common ingredients to the people who are going to be your participants. This is a global show. These ingredients would be common, and people would have eaten them before where I am. Mm-hmm. Also, it is very, very important for all of the food that we have everyone put a label on them. Not what it is called, meatloaf, but what is in it, so that people can judge whether or not they can eat it. Now, I'm already getting people telling me that they can't eat tomatoes and they don't eat meat. In that case, this would be not a safe recipe for a group that you're in. Yeah. That's why we ask first about the allergies, the food prohibitions, and the religious prohibitions to food. But we're going to say that we don't have anybody that has an allergy to tomatoes. And if you don't like the meat part, you can just keep it out and substitute some other kind of vegetable. I use corn when I'm making a vegetarian. I just said that, but it's true. So this is a very basic chili recipe. Mm-hmm. And you add to it as you like. You all know that you have been here before. Thank you for being here, for all your participation, that I tend to cook things bland and leave condiments on the side for people who like it more spicy. Mm-hmm. You can do it yourself. So let's start the chili recipe because, quite frankly, we're starting to run out of time, which is wonderful. It means we had a good discussion. So let's have 2 pounds of ground meat. Mm-hmm. I like it to be kind of lean, otherwise you get a lot of fat. So 2 pounds of ground meat, a couple tablespoons of vegetable oil. Let's have a cup of diced onion, nice big onion that we're going to dice up. Let's have a green pepper that we're going to vein and seed and dice. You can make it kind of uniform with the onion so it looks nice. How about a red pepper also? Yeah, that also looks nice. Let's do the same. We're going to core it and take the veins out and take the seeds, and we're going to dice it up. two cans, which is like 16-ounce cans, of diced tomatoes. We're going to use the juice, too, so don't drain them. You're going to use real tomatoes. Yours will probably be better than mine. And you need to add a little more liquid to this recipe because, remember, we're using the, I'm going to call it the juice that comes with the chopped tomatoes. They are easy for me to get and easy for me to use and also inexpensive. So I'm going to use that. You want to use all fresh, go with it. It's going to be better than mine. I'm actually going to use a little bit of chilies in this because otherwise all we've got is bean stew, right? And I called it chili. I'm going to take one of those little cans. They're 4 ounces, not too many chilies, not the jalapenos. They are too spicy. Those go on the side for those who want to have something really spicy. Just the little can of chopped green chilies that we're going to drain really, really well, because otherwise you get a lot of chili juice in there. You think the whole little can is too much, use less. Mm-hmm. And let's have a teaspoon of chili powder. I know that's not a lot, but I just explained to you that I'm making this not real strong. Let's have a can of kidney beans, also 16-ounce can. We're going to get the slime off them. Oops, did I say that? We're going to take our kidney beans and run them under cold water and pat them dry because you don't want that juice. The juice that's in a kidney bean can is, how shall I put this delicately, not all that good. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a nice big can, a 16-ounce can of pinto beans. Mm-hmm. You can do 2 cans of kidney beans if it's easier. We're also going to rinse and drain those, run them under cold running water. And also get rid of any of the skins that are loose. You know how sometimes there's some that they're just kind of floating around? Get rid of them. They're not going to do you any good. So we're going to get ourselves a nice big pot because there's no sense making extra pots. And we're going to brown our meat in the oil. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of fat in your meat. You can use a little less oil. And we're going to kind of use a wooden spatula, wooden spoon, and break it up and make sure that it's all cooked through. You know, on both sides. We're going to drain out some of the fat. I'm really not big on the fat. I think you should drain all the fat out, come to think of it. And push them to the side. Add the onion, the green pepper, and saute them for about 5 minutes. You've got enough grease in the pot to go with that. And put in everything else. You've got the tomatoes, cans of tomatoes. If you look like you don't have enough liquid in there, and if you specifically used fresh tomatoes or fresh beans also, beans, of course, you'd need to soak, right? Right, yeah. And because they're basically cooked out of the can. You can just eat them as you stand there. Use some tomato juice so that you can make up the liquid. You got to take a look at it. Mm-hmm. Because we're now going to put everything together. We are. And we're going, except for the beans. The beans go in last, really, because you don't want it to squish. So we're going to have the meat and the onion and the peppers and the tomatoes and the tomato juice, if you need some extra liquid, which you probably will. Let's use a cup of tomato juice. The drained green chilies, the chili powder, right? Everything except the beans. We stir them in. We're going to bring it to a boil, which is really why you need the juice from the diced tomatoes and the tomato juice. Bring it to a boil. Reduce the heat. Simmer it. Well, we're making chili. It needs to all incorporate, right? Let's simmer it for about an hour so that it all simmers down and it all incorporates real nice. We're going to take our beans that we rinsed, but they're canned, so they don't need a lot of cooking time because they're really cooked. They're already edible. We're going to throw them both in, and we're going to stir it around. We're going to cover it, and we're going to simmer it for, another half hour until everything's heated through and blended with the meat and the everything else, right? Half an hour, which means that we could start this up until the bean part bring everything, if we had a stove in our facility, wherever we're holding the meeting, and simmer it for half an hour on the stove so that it smells really good and it's really hot when you're sitting there. Yeah, yummy. And this can also, of course, be reheated. I'm not a big advocate of making things the night before, generally speaking. This could be, and then reheated so that it's nice and hot. So that is a basic chili recipe. Don't like the meat? Leave it out. And yes, you can add things to it. That's why it's just basic. It's just the base one. I'm a big advocate of not making things too spicy and having condiments on the side. That's where, in my opinion, the jalapenos go. And the sour cream. Yeah, people are telling all kinds of things to bring. And more onion, more raw onion and things. Yeah, whatever you like. That's why it's to the side so people can choose. So that's our safe recipe. It's not too complicated. Doesn't have too many ingredients. If nobody is allergic to tomatoes, because there's a lot of tomatoes in it. And it can be made into vegetarian if you'd like. Basic recipe. Excellent. And it's really travel friendly. You can bring it in a big pot and reheat it. Yummy. So that's our safe recipe. Do we have time for the tart recipe? Well, we've got a few minutes. Let's give it a try. This is not a real complicated recipe either. It is the adventure recipe because it has ham in it. And ham has a lot of religious prohibition sometimes or dietary prohibition. People don't eat ham. Do not substitute something wet instead of the ham like a tomato because it will not do well. If you want to make this a non-adventure recipe, just leave out the ham and make it an onion tart. So here we go. I actually do not hand make my crusts. You want to do it, yours will come out much finer than mine. I'm going to use a couple of sheets of frozen pie crust pastry. It's delicious and it's pre-made. You want to roll out the pie crust, go for it. Yours will be nicer than mine. You know, of course, when you cook a pie crust, you put it in the pan, the tart pan, like a 9-inch tart pan, and you thaw it first of all, what you thought. You fit it in the pan, like an 8-inch fluted flan tin, one of those little quiche tins, put on a baking sheet, and you put a piece of baking paper on the bottom of the crust, inside, on the top of the crust, inside the pan. And then you put something on it to keep it down because we're going to fill it with a custard, essentially speaking. Yeah, people are saying rice. Whatever you've got, if you've got those little baking beads, the little ceramic baking beads, then you won't waste food. But otherwise, something that's inexpensive and will keep the piece of pastry paper down and keep the crust from rising. It'll make it nice and flat. Does that make sense? Yeah. Dried beans, rice, people are saying. I personally actually own, which is very strange because I hardly ever own these strange things, those little beads, the little ceramic beads. Keep it down. So we're going to bake it until it's nice and brown. We're going to bake it in what? 300-degree oven, 350. What I'm telling you is your pastry crust is done. You've baked it. You want to use a pre-made one, yes, but you need one that can be baked because if you just use the pre-made one, it's going to be soggy on the bottom. So we've got our pie crust done. Now we're going to fill it. We're going to have a couple tablespoons of oil, a whole bunch of onions. How about 3 onions? I'm going to slice them up nice and thin. Half cup of sour cream, 2 eggs, and a half cup of grated cheese of the kind of soft white kind, like Gruyere. Yeah, something that's nice and Swiss type. Yeah. Not Parmesan. It's too hard, surprisingly enough. So we're going to saute our onion. And it takes us a little while because it's quite a bit of onion until it's nice and golden. And we're going to take our lovely onion that we sautéed in the oil, and we're going to put it right on the bottom of our pastry crust, right inside. We're just going to spread it all around, right inside there. We're going to take our cup of cubed cooked ham. Cooked. Did everybody hear the word cooked? Yeah, one cup cooked cubed ham. Little, let's call it diced, really small cubes. Mm-hmm. We're going to put that on top of the onions, right? We're now going to whisk together the sour cream and the eggs. We're going to add the stir in the cheese. And we're going to pour the egg mixture over the onion and the ham. We're going to bake it for 40 minutes in that same nice warm 350 oven. Mm-hmm. Delicious. We're going to bake it until it's nice and brown. Everybody loves it. Yes, you can double the recipe and make lots. Mm-hmm. I think that before you serve it, you should let it sit for a minute so that it gets nice and firm. You know, of course, to test firmness with a toothpick or a bamboo pick or something. It's a little bit longer, toothpicks. I always burn myself. But so that it's nice and set. But it's easy to do. It looks fantastic. Look, you've made quiche, essentially speaking. It is delicious. You want to make a pie crust of your own, go for it. Yours will be better than mine, but those frozen sheets are lovely. And if you want to make it less of an adventure, leave out the ham. But remember that it needs to be cooked. The ham needs to be cooked and cubed small. I hate to say diced because people think diced is really, really minced, but not real big chunks. Because after all, it has to go in with the egg mixture and not sit above it somehow. And you want enough to be all over the bottom of the quiche with the onions and not just lumps, right? Right. So that is our adventure recipe. Mm-hmm. It can be served warmish. You don't have to particularly reheat it. It's even delicious cool, although not refrigerator cold, so that if you don't have facilities to reheat, it's all right. Everybody likes it. It's delicious. Cut into small pieces. So I can see that our time together is, well, it's nearly up. I think we've gone a little past this time, but we had an important discussion. Thank you for coming. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for listening. If you want to contact us, we're recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Website is recipeforpeacenow.com. Last five shows archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows archived on the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. And please do come again. Bye-bye.